The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, my name is Kelly from the Talking Information Center, and today is Friday, the 15th of May, and I will be reading from National Geographic. These articles are mostly from the May 2026 volume of the magazine. And the first article is titled, "There Might Be Three Different Types of ADHD, New Brain Study Suggests," and is written by Helen Bradshaw. ADHD is diagnosed as a single disorder, but in exam rooms, it rarely looks that simple. Some patients struggle primarily with focus. Others can't sit still. Still others wrestle with explosive emotions layered onto both. For patients and clinicians alike, that can mean a treatment process that includes trial and error and at times frustration until the right medication is found. Now, a new brain imaging study released in late February suggests that variability may not be random. Researchers from China, the United States, and Australia analyzed scans from 446 children with ADHD. By examining the gray matter, neuron-packed brain tissue essential for information transmission, the team identified three distinct subtypes, each with its own chemical interactions. The findings raise a provocative possibility. ADHD may not be one disorder expressed differently, but an umbrella for several related conditions with different neural signatures. Some of what this study has shown is what we clinically do anyway, trying to match the symptoms to the actual most effective treatments that we know, says Melissa P. Del Bello, a child psychiatrist at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and a researcher on the project. But it's really nice to have the data to show that our clinical impressions based on years of treating these patients have some biological validity to it. Although the researchers didn't go in searching for predetermined subsets, the biotypes ended up mirroring what clinicians already often see in patients, says Del Bello. Here's what they found. Biotype 1, severe combined type with emotional dysregulation. The first biotype was characterized by brain circuits involved in emotional regulation, including the prefrontal cortex, which is important for self-control in weighing consequences, and the pallidum, which filters impulses before they become behavior, says Manpreet K. Singh, co-author of the study and child psychiatrist at University of California, Davis Health. It's an overloaded control center, Singh says. Emotional and impulse control systems are overwhelmed, and very often the kids show more severe symptoms and more persistent emotional struggles, she says. So this is the very classic ADHD inattention and hyperactivity pattern. Clinically, this group most closely resembles what many people think of as classic ADHD, but amplified. Compared with the control subgroup, these children showed the greatest divergence in brain connectivity. They scored high on both inattentiveness and impulsivity, along with pronounced emotional dysregulation, says Stephen Pliska, a psychiatrist at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, who was not involved in the study. That's severe mood lability, temper tantrums, aggression, he adds. That is the group of ADHD kids who are most at risk for developing future psychiatric problems, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, substance abuse, and criminality. It's an indicator of possible big issues later on. Researchers post that this group requires the earliest clinical interventions of three. Biotype 2, predominantly hyperactive and impulsive. The second biotype was marked less by inattention and more by difficulty regulating impulses. You might describe this as an impulse circuit jam, says Singh, of brain connections characteristic of biotype 2. People struggle to brake on impulses, and it's like the accelerator is strong. The brake timing is slightly off, and traffic flows fast, but unpredictably. You see more hyperactivity and impulsivity. Children in this group showed lower levels of inattentiveness than the other subtypes, but greater disruption in circuits that regulate inhibition. Connectivity differences were strongest between the anterior cingulate cortex, a region that helps monitor errors and apply behavioral breaks in an impulse-specific circuit of the pallidum. When those regions fall out of sync, inhibitory control weakens. The result is less about wandering attention and more about difficulty suppressing impulses. Clinically, that pattern shows up as restlessness, blurting out answers, interrupting, or acting before thinking. Behaviors rooted in a misfiring control system rather than an inability to focus. Biotype 3, predominantly inattentive. Researchers trace the third biotype to disruptions in the superior frontal gyrus, a region that supports working memory and sustained attention. Everything else seems to work, but focus drifts. Singh says, children in this group primarily showed inattention rather than hyperactivity. Clinically, this presentation is often more subtle, and more likely to be overlooked. It is also seen more frequently in girls, says Pliska, who notes that because these children are less disruptive, they may struggle academically for years before coming to clinical attention. Future research. This isn't the first time researchers have attempted to sort ADHD into subgroups. Earlier editions of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders listed three subtypes, now referred to as presentations, to reflect how symptoms shift and overlap over time. There's no perfect prediction algorithm for ADHD, explains Stephen Farron, a psychologist at SUNY Upstate Medical University who was not involved in the study. I've never seen one. Increasingly, researchers view ADHD not as a single discrete disorder, but as a dimension of traits distributed across the population. People with ADHD are the extreme of a dimension because it's continuous. Comparing it to conditions like hypertension, where risk rises along a measurable spectrum, rather than appearing as an all-or-nothing diagnosis. The study's authors stress that their identified biotypes are not new diagnostic categories. The findings will need replication, and ADHD remains a clinical diagnosis based on behavioral evaluation, not brain scans. Parents are often being left like, what is that? Aren't you going to do some tests? But that's the legitimate approach right now, Pliska says. However, if the patterns hold up, researchers hope they could eventually help clinicians better match patients to medications, reducing the trial and error process many families experience. Whether brain scans ever enter the diagnostic toolkit, it validates the diversity and intricacy of ADHD, researchers say. What I hope this article does is signal to people it's more than complicated than just calling it ADHD. Singh says, it's become a household name of how we explain our lives and our experiences, but it may be much more complicated than that. The next article is titled, Why Low-Carb Diets Can Actually Raise Your Risk of Heart Disease, and it's written by Annika Hom. If you're trying to improve your heart health, you've likely been recommended a low-carb or low-fat diet. But according to a new study in Journal of American College of Cardiology, limiting the amount of carbs and fat you eat may not be a silver bullet when it comes to reducing heart disease risk. Harvard researchers analyzed diet, survey data, and health outcomes of some 200,000 health professionals for 30 years and measured their associated risk of developing heart disease. Researchers compared health professionals who ate a low-carb diet and found heart disease risk could actually increase by 14% if the person regularly consumed unhealthy or refined carbs. However, if the person ate healthy carbs like whole grains, risk dropped by 15%. This study suggests that health is not simply about cutting carbs or fats, says Zhu-Hun Wu, postdoctoral research fellow at Harvard University's Department of Nutrition and co-author of the study. Our central message is that diet quality matters more. Because this was an observational study, researchers can't directly prove certain diets actually cause study participants to get heart disease. However, the fact that the study followed a large number of people for a long period of time is impressive, says Camilla Dalby Hansen, a researcher at the University of Southern Denmark, Odense, who is not a part of the study. Researchers went a step further and collected biological data to help counteract potential self-reported bias from the health questionnaires, Wu says. The researchers took blood samples of more than 11,000 participants and were able to measure their metabolomics, the small molecules in cells and tissues, which corroborated their earlier findings. It's a very complicated methodology that they succeeded with, Hansen says. What makes me very happy is the Metabolomics edition. It's super new and exciting. An emphasis on whole foods. The body needs macronutrients, or carbs, proteins, and fats, to give us energy and support our overall health. And there's no shortage of food options to get our macros in. Steak, fruits, oatmeal, fast food, ice cream, vegetables, and more. But there are different qualities of the food we eat. For example, in the study, Harvard researchers distinguished between low-quality, refined carbs and high-quality carbs like whole grains. The study also differentiated the quality of fat sources. A low-quality, unhealthy fat like trans fat or saturated fat, found in foods like red meats, heavy cream, and butter, is not easily metabolized by the body. Unhealthy fats are often associated with higher risk for diseases like type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Contrarily, high-quality, healthy fats like avocados or nuts are easy for the body to break down to use for energy, and they also keep you full. Fats are the most amazing macronutrients ever, Hansen says. They protect your brain health, your hormone function, your skin. They are also cardioprotective, clearing your arteries from the debris. Researchers created different categories of healthy and unhealthy diets when conducting the study. A healthy diet was defined as one that included more plant-based proteins and fats, or high-quality proteins and fats, as well as high-quality carbs. Conversely, an unhealthy diet was defined as rich in low-quality refined carbs and animal proteins and fats, which were considered a low-quality fat source in the study. The results clearly show the difference in fat and carb quality may reduce disease risk, even if participants ate fewer carbs or fats. Specifically, participants who ate high-quality carbs and more plant proteins and fats had a lower heart disease risk compared to those who ate more refined carbs and animal fats and proteins. Furthermore, those who got their protein and fat sources from animals were more positively correlated with having saturated fats and trans fats, which can also increase risk of cardiovascular disease. Hansen believes one limitation of the study is how it simplifies the categories of healthy and unhealthy by ranking animal fats and proteins as unhealthy. In my opinion, all animal proteins and all animal fats are not unhealthy, she says. Wu agrees that some low-fat animal proteins can be beneficial, such as yogurt. Still, other experts point to how this study underscores the extra benefits of whole grains and vegetable protein and fats compared to other types. That is not saying don't consume animal protein, but heavily focus on whole foods and plant-based proteins like fats and legumes and beans, says Jennifer Sachek, a provost professor at Brown University's School of Public Health. Eating heavier on the plant-based side has historically shown greater health benefits. Markers of success in participants' bodies. The blood samples taken throughout the study also provided insight into participants' actual health. Those with healthier versions of low-carb and low-fat diets had higher levels of good cholesterol and lower levels of triglycerides, which are produced when our body has reached a healthy caloric limit. Higher levels of good cholesterol can protect the body from heart disease by clearing out the bad cholesterol from our arteries. The researchers also analyzed metabolites, or molecules left over after our body metabolizes something. If you say you're eating certain things, your metabolome is actually indicating that's the case, Sachek says. One metabolite, hippuric acid, was more greatly associated with participants who followed a healthier low-carb and low-fat diet. Hippuric acid can be another indicator of a diet rich in fruits and vegetables. The findings validate the risk modeling and suggest that healthier diets do lead to better biological outcomes. Interestingly, Wu says that both those who followed a healthy low-carb diet and healthy low-fat diet had overlapping signs of good health. To him, this underscores how we have more choice in the type of diet we want to follow. In this case, low-carb or low-fat, as long as we focus on eating whole foods and sources of high-quality fats and carbs. I think that provides more flexibility with your preference, while still providing more cardiovascular protections, Wu says. The next article is titled, The Science of Why Chia Seeds Are a Superfood, and it's written by Stacy Colino. Don't let their diminutive size deceive you. Chia seeds are absolutely packed with nutrients, including soluble and insoluble fiber, protein, healthy fats, antioxidants, and various minerals. There's nothing negative about them, says Keith Ayoub, a registered dietitian nutritionist in New York City and an associate professor emeritus of pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. They're loaded with a lot of the things people are missing. In fact, 2 tablespoons of chia seeds contain nearly 10 grams of fiber and 5 grams of protein, along with sufficient amounts of calcium, iron, magnesium, and potassium, and small amounts of folate, vitamin A, selenium, and zinc. These dark gray, egg-shaped seeds come from the desert plant Salvia hispanica, which belongs to the mint family, and they were once believed to be a staple in the ancient Aztec diet in Central America. We have scientific evidence that they're good for gut and cardiovascular health, including blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol, says Wendy Bazillion, a nutrition and wellness expert in San Diego and host of the 1000 Waking Minutes podcast. Indeed, some scientists have called chia seeds a therapeutic weapon against metabolic disorders. Not everyone knows how to consume chia seeds, so here's the lowdown. To soak or not to soak. Chia seeds absorb 10 times their weight in water, according to Dawn Jackson Blattner, a registered dietitian nutritionist in Chicago and author of The Superfood Swap. Because of this, experts often recommend soaking them in liquid before consuming them. Otherwise, the seeds could cause bloating or other forms of gastrointestinal discomfort. Soaking makes it more likely that they'll feel good in the digestive tract, Blattner says, and you will feel more full if you soak them first. That's because as they absorb water, chia seeds expand and develop a gelatinous texture. But you don't have to soak them first. It's about comfort and usability. Soaking doesn't unlock key nutrients, says Bazillion, but instead makes chia seeds easier to digest. How to soak your chia seeds. If you're going to soak them, combine 1/4 cup of chia seeds with a cup of milk or water and let the mixture sit for at least 10 minutes, Ayoub suggests, although you can soak them overnight. A pro tip. Before soaking, measure these over the sink because if they spill, you'll never stop finding them, even in other rooms, Ayoub warns. Once they're soaked, use them right away or refrigerate them for consumption later. How to incorporate chia seeds into your diet. Don't get too hung up on the soaking. That gets in the way of people using them, Blattner says. In lieu of soaking, you can sprinkle dry chia seeds on yogurt, cereal, salads, or vegetables. Just be sure to drink plenty of fluids as you consume them. Otherwise, they're going to swell up somewhere down the GI tract, Ayoub says. Because they're high in fiber, add them gradually to your diet to get your system used to them. You can also incorporate the seeds in smoothies, soups, and stews, in which case they'll absorb liquid naturally and thicken the food. Consider adding chia seeds to batter for muffins, pancakes, or bread. And if you want to use them as an egg substitute, Blattner says, you can mix 1 tablespoon of chia seeds with 3 tablespoons of water and let the mixture soak for 10 to 15 minutes. Other possibilities include making chia pudding by soaking 1/4 cup of chia seeds in 1 cup of milk of choice in a lidded jar in the refrigerator for a few hours or overnight, or jam by cooking and mashing 2 cups of berries or other fruit on the stove, then stirring in 2 tablespoons of chia seeds, Blattner says. It develops a jam-like consistency, and you can put it in the fridge for up to a week. If you do decide to add chia seeds to your diet, it's important to consume them regularly. A superfood can't be a one-trick pony, Bazillion says. You need to be able to eat enough of it, and chia seeds are versatile. The next article is titled The Surprising Health Benefits of Everyday Herbs, and it's written by Stacy Colino. When it comes to herbs and spices, cinnamon, turmeric, and ginger tend to get all the glory. But scientific evidence is mounting that you can reap real health perks from consuming parsley, sage, rosemary, thyme, and other culinary herbs, which do more than simply add flavor to food. Basically, herbs are leafy greens. They're the leafy parts of certain plants, says Jackie Nugent, a registered dietitian nutritionist, chef, and author of the Plant-Based Diabetes Cookbook. Even though they're generally not used in large quantities, you can still think of herbs as veggies in terms of their potential health benefits. How do herbs work their magic? One key attribute is that herbs are powerhouses of antioxidant compounds, says Wendy Bazillion, a nutrition and wellness expert in San Diego and host of the 1000 Waking Minutes podcast. Antioxidants protect the body by neutralizing harmful, unstable molecules called free radicals, which can which cause oxidative stress and damage to cells, DNA, and other vital structures inside us. Research suggests that consuming significant amounts of antioxidants from plant-based foods may help protect you against cardiovascular disease, certain forms of cancer, including prostate cancer, and neurodegenerative disorders. Herbs are also filled with compounds that fight inflammation in the body. In a 2026 literature review published in the journal Nutrients, researchers analyze existing research of the anti-inflammatory effects of coriander, sage, mint, basil, rosemary, oregano, and thyme. They found that these herbs demonstrated anti-inflammatory effects at maximum daily doses of 3 grams, approximately 1 tablespoon, for individual herbs or 6.6 grams of a combination of herbs. The phytochemicals and bioactive compounds that protect herbs and other plants from microbes, including bacteria and fungi, are also helpful for protecting humans from health threats, says Alexandra Kazaks, a registered dietitian nutritionist and member of the nutrition division of the Institute of Food Technologists. What's more, herbs have so many positives, including vitamins and minerals and other health-promoting compounds, Bazillion says. They make foods we need to eat more of, like fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, proteins, and yogurt, taste delicious. Specific herbs come with their own unique health benefits, too. From basil's positive influence on gut health to rosemary's ability to suppress allergic responses. Usually a few teaspoons or tablespoons a day can make a difference. And together, they have a cumulative effect in promoting good health. Here's a closer look at how various herbs compare, plus ideas for how to easily incorporate them into your meals. First is basil. This flavorful leafy green herb is loaded with antioxidants, as well as anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, and immunomodulatory properties. Plus, 2 tablespoons worth of fresh chopped basil contains vitamins A and K, calcium, magnesium, potassium, among other nutrients. Research has found that consuming 5 milligrams of basil syrup at night can alleviate anxiety in people being treated with sertraline for depression. By increasing the presence of beneficial bacteria, it can also improve gut health and metabolic health, including blood sugar and cholesterol. Meanwhile, its antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and other beneficial properties suggest that basil can help fight cancer, viruses, and other infections. How to cook with basil? One of the simplest preparations is to use whole fresh basil leaves on a caprese salad with sliced tomatoes and fresh mozzarella, says Nugent. Or you can add fresh or dried basil to pasta, pizza, egg dishes, soups, roasted chicken, stir fries, or even cocktails. Next is cilantro. Cilantro can be polarizing. People either love it or hate it. Some people in the latter camp have a gene variant that causes them to experience a soapy taste with cilantro. This citrusy herb contains vitamins A, C, and K, folate, potassium, carotenoids, and traces of other nutrients, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Research suggests that consuming cilantro and coriander, seeds from the same plant as cilantro, Coriandrum sativum, is beneficial for anxiety and depression, protecting brain health, and supporting cardiovascular health. The theory is that these effects are due to the combined action of its phytochemicals, which have antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and other health-promoting properties. In addition, there's some evidence that cilantro may help protect against obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, thanks to its polyphenol content. Polyphenols are antioxidant-rich compounds in plant-based foods. How to cook with cilantro? Consider adding the fresh leaves to curries, soups, salsas, and bean dishes, for an extra burst of flavor, Bazillion suggests. Next is oregano. Part of the mint family, oregano has high anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and antibacterial activities thanks to the flavonoids and phenolic acids it contains. These phytochemical compounds are also considered to have anti-cancer properties as they are believed to alter hormone activity in helpful ways, induce enzymes that detoxify the body, regulate immune function, and prevent or slow the growth of cells. In addition to helping your body fight free radicals, consuming 25 milliliters or approximately 5 teaspoons of oregano oil after each meal for 3 months has been found to reduce harmful LDL cholesterol and increase health-promoting HDL cholesterol among people with mild cholesterol abnormalities. A teaspoon of ground oregano contains an impressive amount of calcium, potassium, and vitamins A and K, as well as traces of folate, magnesium, and other nutrients. How to cook with oregano. You might add oregano to potatoes or chicken before roasting them, or brush a mixture of oregano with extra virgin olive oil and garlic onto zucchini or eggplant before grilling or roasting it, advises Nugent. Next is parsley. It's often thought of as a garnish, but parsley is actually a nutritional superstar, given that it contains a substantial amount of fiber, calcium, iron, magnesium, potassium, as well as vitamin C, folate, and vitamins A and K. In addition, parsley is packed with antioxidants and other bioactive compounds that may play a role in supporting heart health, says Nugent. In fact, parsley has been shown to have anti-hypersensitive and cholesterol-lowering properties, while also promoting blood flow and inhibiting blood clotting. How to cook with parsley. Besides adding fresh parsley to green and grain salads, you can put the fresh or dried form into stews, pasta, egg concoctions, and bean dishes, Bazillion says. Nugent recommends blending fresh parsley with pistachios, extra virgin olive oil, lemon juice, and sea salt, and drizzling it over roasted veggies or grilled fish, chicken, or tofu. That sounds delicious. Next is rosemary. Rosemary is rich in various plant-based substances that have antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. The strong herbal aroma of rosemary is actually an indicator of its bioactive compounds, which may be linked with anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial properties, says Nugent. Indeed, rosemary extract has been shown to suppress allergic responses and nasal congestion, largely by reducing inflammation and inhibiting mast cell activation, which triggers allergy symptoms. It also has been used to improve mood and memory, pain, sleep, and other neurological conditions, thanks in part to its anti-inflammatory activities as well as the effects of its compounds on neurotransmitters, brain chemicals. What's more, a tablespoon of dried rosemary contains vitamin A, folate, potassium, magnesium, and 42 milligrams of calcium. Rosemary can even be used to preserve food and to decrease spoilage due to its high antioxidant and antimicrobial actions, says Kazax. How to cook with rosemary. Rosemary can stand up to heat in cooking, says Bazillion, so it's a worthy addition to roasted potatoes, chicken, fish, and vegetables. And the last is thyme. A perennial wild shrub, thyme is rich in vitamins such as A, B6, C, E, and K, minerals like potassium, calcium, iron, and magnesium, and phytonutrients such as carotenoids and flavonoids. The fragrant herb is known for its antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, antiviral, antibacterial, and antiseptic activities. This is why thyme may play a role in protecting respiratory health and cardiac health, as both are affected by inflammation and oxidative stress. How to cook with thyme. Consider adding fresh thyme leaves to vegetable soups, sautéed mushrooms, or white bean dishes. You could also use fresh or dried thyme in salad dressings and marinades, Bazillion says. Lots of great tips here. Okay, and now moving on from food articles. The next one is titled, Doctors Have Long Said Cartilage Can't Regenerate. They're now rethinking that. And it's written by Lindsay Coulter. Cartilage rarely gets attention until it begins to fail. For decades, arthritis patients have heard the same verdict. When cartilage wears away, it does not grow back. Unlike many tissues in the body, cartilage has little blood supply, which limits its ability to repair itself after injury. That biological limitation helps explain why osteoarthritis, caused by the gradual breakdown of cartilage, affects 1 in 5 adults in the United States and remains a leading cause of disability worldwide. With no approved drug able to slow or reverse the disease, treatment typically focuses on managing pain and managing mobility through physical therapy. When damage becomes severe, the remaining option is often joint replacement surgery. The prevailing assumption has been that cartilage loss is inevitable, a mechanical consequence of lengthening lifespans. Now, scientists are beginning to challenge that assumption. Instead of only cushioning damage or replacing joints, they are exploring whether cartilage can be coaxed to repair itself. A scaffold designed to rebuild cartilage. One approach focuses on rebuilding cartilage from the ground up. Motion is a fingerprint. It's a marker of life, says Samuel Stupp, a chemist and material scientist at Northwestern University. If we're not able to move without pain, it's hard to be whole. STEP's research is built around the idea that restoring cartilage's structure can help trigger its regeneration. His team has designed an injectable material meant not only to replace what has been lost, but to create conditions that encourage new cartilage to grow. The scaffold, made from short protein fragments in a modified form of hyaluronic acid, is delivered directly into damaged areas of the joint. Once there, it assembles itself into tiny fibers that weave together into a soft but resilient mesh. The structure closely resembles healthy cartilage and, just as importantly, provides signals that guide surrounding cells toward building new tissue rather than forming scar-like repair. To see how the material performs under real-world stress, the researchers tested it in sheep, whose knee joints resemble those of humans in size and the forces they endure. Over 6 months, joints treated with the scaffold began forming new cartilage rich in collagen II in proteoglycans, the molecules that give healthy cartilage its strength and flexibility. The repaired tissue looked and behaved more like native cartilage than the weaker fibrocartilage that often forms after standard treatments such as microfracture surgery, pointing to a repair that could last. How aging changes cartilage's ability to repair itself. But rebuilding cartilage's structure is only one piece of the puzzle. Aging itself can make joints less capable of repair. At Stanford University, researchers are turning their attention to the biology of aging and the molecular changes that make cartilage less capable of repair. Helen Blau, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, discovered and continues to study a protein called 15-PGDH that rises steadily with age. The enzyme breaks down a key molecule essential to tissue repair, slowing regeneration and causing tissue to lose function. These proteins are referred to as gerozymes, molecular regulators that shape the biology of aging. Blau and her colleague, Nidhi Puthani, an associate professor of orthopedic surgery, discovered that in older mice, locking 15-PGDH reversed the cartilage loss that normally accompanies aging in the knee. In animals with injuries resembling ACL tears, the treatment prevented osteoarthritis from taking hold. Treated mice moved more slowly and put more weight on their injured limbs, a sign that their joints were functioning better. Human tissue echoed those findings. Cartilage samples taken from the knee replacement surgeries responded to the inhibitor in the lab by producing new, functional hyaline cartilage, the smooth, resilient tissue that allows joints to glide. People with joint pain are desperate to find relief, and they have very limited options, says Blau. Puthani adds, this new inhibitor can address the root cause of pain by repairing the damage to the cartilage. Stopping the inflammation that destroys joints. Aging can slowly erode cartilage, but inflammation can destroy it quickly. At the Mayo Clinic, Christopher Evans, a professor of orthopedic surgery and molecular medicine, is focused less on regrowing cartilage, but on tackling the inflammatory signals that drive the disease itself. If we can stop the cycle of inflammation, we can preserve the joint before it fails, says Evans. Evans has spent decades studying interleukin-1, a protein that helps the body respond to injury. In healthy tissue, its role is brief. In osteoarthritis, it lingers, fueling inflammation and accelerating cartilage breakdown. Blocking it with injected drugs has proven difficult because proteins introduced into a joint are quickly washed away through blood vessels in the lymphatic system. Gene therapy offered a way around that problem. Evans and his colleagues delivered genetic instructions directly to the knee, prompting joint cells to produce their own supply of a natural anti-inflammatory protein. After a single injection, the joint became its own source of treatment, maintaining local levels of the protective molecule rather than losing it within hours. In an early safety trial, levels of the protein remained elevated in joint fluid for at least a year, with no serious side effects linked to the therapy. Participants reported less pain and improved function, though the study was small and not designed to measure long-term outcomes. Larger trials are now underway. The aim is not to rebuild cartilage outright, but to interrupt the inflammatory cycle that hastens its loss and preserves the joint before it fails. None of these strategies has yet proven durable in large human trials, but together they reflect a shift in how scientists think about osteoarthritis. long framed as inevitable wear and tear, the disease is increasingly understood as living biology, shaped by molecules, cells, and structure that may yet respond to intervention. The next article is titled, Where is Tornado Alley? How the deadliest storm zone in the U.S. is shifting east, and it's written by Megan Wallerton. Tornadoes are some of the most destructive natural disasters seen in the United States each year, and twisters are 10 times more common in Tornado Alley. But for tornado expert Stephen Strader, the term Tornado Alley may be a bit outdated. We've had devastating tornadoes outside of what people consider Tornado Alley, the Villanova University associate professor explains, and the disastrous phenomenon is only expected to get worse. Drier conditions in the Great Plains, coupled with increased moisture in the southeast, is shifting tornado activity away from states like Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. Scientists attribute this shift to the east to climate change. It's a very subtle shift, Strader says. Cities like Dallas and Austin, Texas, are seeing four fewer tornado days per decade, with an increase in tornado activity in places further east like Memphis, Tennessee. Still, the shift is notable, says Jana Hauser, associate geography professor at Ohio State University. We are seeing places that are not expecting tornadoes that to become victims to tornadoes. In 2024, six different tornado outbreaks caused billions of dollars in damage each, many of which affected states outside of Tornado Alley, such as Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Kentucky, to name a few. Here's what you should know about Tornado Alley and why the shift is impacting millions of Americans. How do tornadoes form? Strader compares the severe weather phenomenon to baking a cake. If you go into your cupboard and you go into your fridge and you pull out butter, you pull out sugar, and you set them on the counter, those are the ingredients you need to make a cake, Strader explains. For severe weather, we look for ingredients similarly, but those ingredients are related to the atmospheric conditions. Those ingredients include heat and moisture, drier air above the warm air, and wind shear, or changes in wind speed and direction that can create the rotation that forms a tornado, Strader says. The dry air high up in the atmosphere comes from the Rocky Mountains and forms what's called a cap that slows or even prevents the development of a tornado, he adds. What we know is that as climate change continues to increase, that cap is getting stronger and stronger, which means that storms that used to occur in eastern Oklahoma may now be starting to occur in central Arkansas, Strader explains. It basically means you're going to have to bake your cake longer. What states are in Tornado Alley? Tornado Alley spreads across much of the Great Plains and Midwest regions of the United States. Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska, as well as parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Missouri, and Iowa, feel the effects of the twisters that are common in the area. In 1948, two Air Force officers tasked with monitoring severe weather in the Great Plains correctly predicted a tornado would hit Oklahoma's Tinker Air Force Base, where they were stationed, marking the start of modern tornado warnings. 4 years later, the same officers first used the term Tornado Alley to refer to the region of Texas, Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma where they track storms. But even though its boundaries are shifting, experts say Tornado Alley, as we know it, isn't going away anytime soon. We don't expect traditional Tornado Alley to disappear, and that's because the ingredients that make severe weather tornadoes, the Rocky Mountains and the Gulf of Mexico, are critical for that, and we're not going to remove those. The rising tornado risk in the Southeast. Because the Southeast region of the U.S. is historically less familiar with tornadoes, this eastern shift poses distinct risks for those in the area. With a larger population than the Great Plains, the eastern half of the country is more likely to experience tornadoes in developed areas, where there's an increased risk of property damage and fatalities. The region also has more trees that reduce visibility during storms, making it more difficult to see the path of a tornado and understand the immediate danger, Strader explains. A new map released by the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration shows an increased probability of a tornado occurring in the eastern United States. From 1994 to 2024, places like southern Illinois, western Kentucky, and western Tennessee had a 90 to 100% likelihood of a tornado touching down there each year, compared to a 60 to 70% likelihood covering most of the same area from 1955 to 2024. Storm chaser and National Geographic explorer Anton Simon says that there are several reasons for the evolution of Tornado Alley's map. Some of what you're seeing on this map is simply better detection, which makes it trying to find signals that may be related to things like climate change harder to detect, he explains. Simone also underscores Strader's urbanization research, noting that as cities expand, more structures, people, and infrastructure are placed in harm's way, increasing disaster vulnerability. The tornado that was in the middle of a field 50 years ago is not going through a field today. It's going through the middle of a brand new subdivision, Strader explains. The growing U.S. population is an even bigger concern than climate change, Strader says. That's scary to us, because that's like saying if we woke up in a world without climate change, we'd still have a growing tornado problem. But climate change isn't going anywhere. So now what we have is this multiplicative effect, Strader says. Impacts aren't going up in a straight line. Impacts are exponentially growing. How scientists can better predict tornadoes. On April 9, 1953, radar technology identified a forming tornado for the first time, revolutionizing public safety and drastically increasing warning times. More advanced Doppler radars followed in the 1960s and are still widely used today to predict tornadoes. We've had great improvements in scientific understanding and continual improvements in technologies, but there's something fundamentally missing in our understanding of which storm is actually going to make a tornado, says Simone. From AI to computer modeling, researchers are working to advance tornado prediction. But according to Simone, the Earth's surface may be the answer to improving tornado prediction. Simone is researching how tornadoes form from the ground up, using cameras to monitor the earliest stages of rotation and identify when tornado strength winds develop at or near the surface. What's our likelihood of success? How many storms actually have recognizable signatures? Well, we don't know unless we try, right? Says Simone. What Simone hopes is that these changes could give forecasters more tools to issue warnings. How to stay safe as tornado threats expand across the U.S. If you're home when a tornado strikes, find an interior room without windows on the lowest level, ideally a basement. You can also cover yourself with a mattress or a blanket for extra protection. If you're driving, get out of your car and look for a ditch or any low-lying area away from trees. Protect your head with your hands. Hauser warns to never park your car under a bridge due to the increased wind speed. Updating your emergency weather plans in case of a tornado is also best to keep your family safe. The number one thing that everyone can do is that if you live east of the Continental Divide, you should have an NOAA weather radio, Strader says. These radios stay on 24/7, but only alert you during severe weather. Tornado warning sirens were originally used to alert people to bomb raids during the Cold War, Strader explains. They actually were never meant to be heard indoors, so you can't rely on them. Strader also encourages homeowners to build structures that are better able to withstand tornadoes. For manufactured homes, improving how they are secured to the ground will go a long way toward protecting you and your family. Experts recommend checking with your insurance company to see if your plan offers incentives for strengthening your home against natural disasters. The reality is that things are changing, and we need to anticipate those changes as a society in an effort to stay ahead of the vulnerabilities that we're introducing by climate change, Hauser says. The next article is titled, Air Pollution Distracts Insects from Pollination and Sex, and it's written by Gennaro Toma. Air pollution is a widespread issue affecting millions of people around the world, causing disastrous effects. But we humans are not the only ones to suffer from unclean air. In the last decade, a growing body of research has started to demonstrate how air pollutants disrupt many aspects of insects' lives too. Pollination, behavior toward each other, and even sex. The main air pollutants that scientists are most concerned about in insects are nitrogen oxides and ozone. Both naturally present in the atmosphere and increasing due to human activities. Those gases can react with and break down some of the compounds that insects use to communicate with each other, or that guide the communication between insects and plants. Science is revealing that air pollutants can affect insects and plants even at levels considered safe for humans. While this field of research is still at its early stages, the more we find out, the more we see that there's really big potential impacts on these ecological communities, says Jeffrey Raffel, sensory ecologist at the University of Washington. Ants hurt each other in their confusion. Pollution can hamper the social life of one of the most social animals of all, ants. Ozone gas can turn members of the same colony against each other, according to a new study published February in the journal PNAS. Smell plays a major role in ants' world. Each colony usually has its own signature odor, and when a creature with an unfamiliar smell enters the colony, ants usually turn against it. Ozone, however, can slightly change that odor by interacting with hydrocarbons, which play a role in the colony's scent on ants' bodies. The team reared five different ant species in the lab for months, growing artificial colonies with hundreds of workers. Then they picked four workers who lived in the same colony and put them in a box with sugar water. After 4 days, they would take one of the ants out and expose it to an increased levels of ozone, similar to those you would measure outside on a polluted day, for around 20 minutes, which is the amount of time an ant would usually spend outside of the colony looking for food. Scientists film how the ants interacted afterward. In four out of five species, if an ant had been exposed to ozone, the nestmates reacted aggressively when it returned. While an ant entering a foreign colony would usually be killed, the attacks toward the nestmates in the experiment were usually not deadly. Still, if every time when you come back, you become attacked and have to deal with it for 5 or 10 minutes, that might be enough to mess up the whole structure of the colony, says Marcus Naden, an animal behavior scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology and Study co-author. The team also found out that in the case of the raider ant, the only species where the nestmates didn't attack each other in the reaction to ozone, the pollutant affected the insects in another subtle way. This species use odors to define tasks in the colony. Larvae, for example, are known to ask for food using a partially chemically based communication, says Naden. But in an experiment involving increased levels of ozone, the ants stopped taking care of the larvae, possibly because that communication channel got somehow disrupted. The impact is relatively minor on the pheromones that these ants are producing, but it's having a really big behavioral impact, says Reifel, who wasn't involved in the study. Naden and his team believe their results can apply to many other species of ants, especially those that are active during the day when ozone levels are higher, and to species that don't build nests underground, but, for example, on trees where they are more exposed to air pollutants. Love is not in the air. Other studies on pollinators, such as hawk moths and bumblebees, show how air pollutants can mess up the signals emitted by flowers to attract insects, making it more difficult for the critters to find the flowers and so feeding and pollinating. Air pollutants break down chemical compounds that form the basis of their communication channel, despite the fact that flowers and their pollinators have co-evolved over millions of years, says Naden. Early-stage research is also showing that exposure to high levels of ozone can cause physiological stress in some insects, possibly leading to alterations in their behavior. Ozone has also been shown to possibly affect bumblebees' ability to learn. Some insects' antennae also seem to become less sensitive after exposure to ozone. Particulate matter can play a role, too, covering insects' antennae, possibly reducing their sensitivity and therefore their ability to sense chemicals. It has all these sorts of downstream impacts that are not only impacting their ability to perceive the world, but also can be affecting their physiology as well, says Reifel. The effects of air pollutants go further, affecting the sex lives of insects too. Just like in a dramatic romance novel, when the sex pheromones, which play a role in attraction and mating, gets broken down by air pollutants, the insects are unable to find mates. In two studies published in 2023 and 2024 in Nature Communication, Naden and his team investigated such effects on drosophilid flies. In these insects, males usually attract females using sex pheromones. But as air pollutants cause the pheromones to deteriorate, the team showed males became less attractive in the eyes of the females. Deteriorated pheromones also led males to court other males, since they didn't smell like males anymore. Individuals from different species even began to breed with each other, as females could not distinguish between males of different species anymore. Naden hypothesizes that the effects of air pollution on the sex lives of insects might turn out to be the most dramatic ones. Pollutants are probably able to alter and disrupt the function of sex pheromones of most insect species through chemical interactions, says Naden. I think that is the very dramatic thing that might happen that no one has really taken a look at. In the case of feeding, research suggested that some insects might be able to learn and adapt to recognize and follow the flower smell altered by pollutants. But when it comes to sex, insects can't learn to recognize and go after differently scented sex pheromones than those they evolved to, says Naden. Impacts on humans. With many questions unanswered, only the effects of a few species of insects have been studied so far. Rifle says that research should move out of the lab, too, to investigate directly in the field the effects these pollutants are having on insects. Another step is also try to understand how air pollution impact insects differently around the world. Some insects don't see these deleterious effects of pollution. Agricultural pests, such as aphids, are less impacted, and some even increase under air pollution by taking advantage of lower defenses in pollution-stressed plants, says James Riles, ecologist at the University of Reading. But on a broader scale, all over the world, insects are declining due to different threats such as loss of habitat and pesticides. Air pollution is one more threat to population numbers. The consequences might even spill over into the human realm, experts say. There's now enough evidence to show that air pollution really modifies, say, pollination, and we really require pollinators for our food security, for our crop production, etc., says Riefel. I think what we need to do now is start to be able to forecast how these pollutants are potentially shaping our ability to have food in the grocery store. The next article is titled, Why Do Gulls Steal Our Food? Scientists experimented with French fries to find out. And it's written by Marlene Zook. Animal ecologist Laura Kelly began studying gulls because she had a six-month-old baby. The child didn't encourage her exactly, but when she took a faculty position at the Cornwall campus of the University of Exeter, doing her usual fieldwork on bowerbirds in Australia wasn't practical. Gulls, though, were everywhere. It's hard to ignore gulls in Cornwall. They are ubiquitous and noisy, nesting on roofs of houses and flying over the street. As in many coastal places, people there have widely different opinions about gulls, from loving them as symbols of the sea to calling them rats with wings. The birds pester beachgoers and swipe French fries at park benches. Gulls thus have a bit of a PR problem. They can be more in your face than many of us would like, especially when consoling a child holding an empty ice cream cone after a gull has dive-bombed it. The droppings on cars and city benches can be hard to take, and most of us even get their names wrong. Aiming to understand whether gulls truly deserve the bad rap, Kelly teamed up with her University of Exeter colleague, Neilt J. Bogart, who also had a young family and was looking for local research on animal behavior. As a behavioral ecologist myself, I became interested in their efforts while working on a book about outsider animals or species, including gulls, that are often seen as intruders in our daily lives. We do have to share our environment with these animals. They were here first, Kelly argues, so if we can find a way to coexist, so much the better. Their recent research and that of others in the field has offered gulls some redemption from their piratical reputation. It has also opened a window into how animal minds work, why one gull isn't like the next, and how we can learn to live with urban wildlife. Some gulls steal your food, but not all of them. The first thing you need to know about gulls is that most people get their names wrong. Ornithologists and birders never use the designation seagull. It's just gull, period. That terminology reflects the cosmopolitan distribution of the birds. Many species spend most of their time far from the ocean, and many are also equally at home in cities and remote clifftops. Over 50 species occur, and they are found on every continent, including Antarctica. But back to the question of gulls stealing your food. Like it or not, taking food from other species is a gull signature move. Many gulls are what are termed kleptoparasites, animals that take food from other individuals, whether their own or different species. This foraging technique is also practiced by other seabirds such as skuas and even bald eagles. But we tend not to notice the others since they do not ply their trade so close to us. When birds take food from other birds, they fly after their target, diving at it until it eventually, at least some of the time, drops its prey, whereupon the gull or skua captures it and flies away. This behavior takes a markedly different set of skills than taking a sandwich from an unwary beachgoer. And Kelly and other scientists have examined the details of how and when gulls get food from people and what might get them to stop. They first asked whether gulls responded to humans when they tried to grab food. The researchers sat down on the shore and set a plastic bag of potato chips about a yard and a half away. The bag was weighted down so that a gull couldn't actually snatch the chips and run, but the scientists could see how the birds reacted. Once a gull approached, the scientists did one of two things: either stare directly at the bird as it advanced on the snack, or studiously gaze in a different direction until the telltale rustle of the bag indicated that the gull was about to take the chips. Of the 74 gulls that unwittingly participated in the experiment, only 27, or a little over a third, approached the food, and just 19 went all the way, so to speak, and attempted to grab it. And the gulls paid attention to whether they were being watched or not, with more of them going for the chips when the researcher was looking away than when they were staring. The researchers point out that the small proportion of gulls trying to take the chips suggests that the birds are more fearful of humans than people often believe, and furthermore, that sensitivity to behaviors like gaze direction might indicate a rather sophisticated cognitive ability on the part of the gulls. My own take is that the variation among individuals is the most intriguing part of the study. What makes some gulls and not others take up a life of crime? Another study made that variation even clearer. University of Sussex biologists Paul Graham and students Franziska Feist and Kira Smith had already seen gulls timing their feeding so that they showed up when the school children were about to discard food scraps. They wondered if the birds were capable of distinguishing whether objects in their environment had been handled by a person, which presumably would indicate their desirability. The scientists used potato chips again in their original packages of either blue or green. The person running the test set both colors of chip bags on the beach and held another pack in his or her hand. Of the gulls that pecked at one of the packets, virtually all tried the same color bag that was held by the experimenter. Gulls, then, are remarkably astute observers, which means that trying to discourage them from taking our lunches may involve making sure they don't see us eating anything ourselves. Again, though, only about a fifth of the gulls that were tested grabbed a bag of chips. It wasn't because they hadn't been paying attention either. Some of the gulls who didn't grab chips went to the spot where the experimenter had been sitting after the trial ended and the person had moved away, which suggests they remembered what had taken place. Perhaps some individuals specialize in snaring human food, while others pursue a more conventional diet of fish or mollusks. Dogs and horses also pay attention to human cues about where food is or what is edible, but we often think their sensitivity to our reactions reflects an evolutionary history of domestication. It's obviously beneficial for our pets to work animals to notice what we do, but such behavior seems more unexpected in gulls. Gulls didn't evolve with humans, much less potato chips, so their ability to grasp the difference between what humans prefer to eat and what they don't suggests that their cognition may be on par with animals, usually thought to be exceptionally clever, like crows. As with many animals we take for granted or dismiss as pests, there is far more to gulls than meets the eye. Kelly didn't start out with a fondness for gulls, but now she says, "I find them charming." To me, gulls are avian Boy Scouts. They're loyal, friendly, cheerful, brave, and clean. And while they don't seem particularly reverent or obedient, that's a lot to ask of a young boy, let alone a bird. That's all we have time for today. Again, I'm Kelly with the Talking Information Center. I hope you enjoyed and learned as much as I did. Have a great day.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Sam Sham and his wife Sandy waited in their driveway for an opening in the heavy traffic. "It's like this every morning," grumbled Sam. "Don't get uptight," warned Sandy. "You need to watch your ulcer." Spotting an opening, Sam shot into traffic with tires squealing. "Take it easy," warned Sandy. "What's for dinner tonight?" Sam asked her. "Reservations," mumbled Sandy, looking out her window. Several minutes later, Sam drove through an intersection and crashed into a garbage truck. He flew through the windshield. Sandy, who was unhurt, was hysterical when she called 911. When asked where the accident occurred, Sandy couldn't say. Why not?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
Sandy wasn't anywhere near the scene of the accident. She and Sam had left for work at the same time in different cars. They were talking on their cell phones when the accident occurred.
And now back to our regular programming.